Normally, what I do, if you don't know me and you're just new, I'm Roy Hemmerling. I'm from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. I live in Fargo. And this week I'm talking about Christian mysticism, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But as at the beginning of each class, I have what's called a mindfulness moment. We're experimenting a little bit with this at Concordia with our students to see if we can find a way to give them moments of silence and space and things like that. And so I want to do another one of those today. Normally, mindfulness moments are, I just encourage students to close their eyes. We're quiet for a few minutes, up to like 5 minutes. And then usually I end it by using some readings that tie us into the next text. But I had an experience today that I'm not going to do a mindfulness moment there where we have our eyes closed. We're going to do a sighted mindfulness moment. And to do it slightly different. So since the timing on this experience that I had today with my wife fit the topic so well, I'm going to show it to you. And so we'll do that, but we're still getting some people in the back, so we'll wait till they kind of get set up. I'm going to make sure I've got my things all set, my ducks in a row. In this mindfulness moment, what I'm going to do, this is about a 4-minute video clip that I took this afternoon on a hike. It was, if you're wondering where I'm standing on the bridge going across to, just got past, was it 10 Mile Falls? And there's that wooden bridge there. And you're on your way to Monkey Bear. So we had this experience where we were on the bridge and suddenly, I'll show you what happened. What I'd like you to do in the mindfulness moment as you're watching this, just let your mind be clear and enjoy the moment and see.
Can you turn off?
Yeah, I'll turn off some lights. Yeah. Okay. Are there some lights in the back? Okay. What I'm going to do is I'll let the sound run. What you'll hear is just kind of a rushing. And that's because I'm standing on the bridge, the edge of the bridge, and you'll hear the water. Okay, so the next few minutes we'll just let our minds enjoy. Oops. usually I don't comment on mindfulness moments, and then I just kind of move into, but for those of you who walked in late, that's something we saw on the trail today, and it kind of reminded me, so I hit the lights for me, please. What we were about today, I really appreciated the fact that some people were giggling a little bit as they were watching it, that it kind of brought you joy. That was exactly, I was sitting there with the camera, like, you know, the deer was right there, and I just kind of going, I was afraid to move, and the deer's ears were kind of, you know, flipping around. So I think that's one of those moments that I was talking about yesterday. I hope this thing turns off. I thought I turned it on. Okay, thanks. Welcome to this session. Yesterday, the theme of the week is the Mysterium Tremendum, and for those of you who weren't here, I started yesterday with some definitions and some ideas, and just as a very quick recap, the term Mysterium Tremendum is kind of in the Latin tradition in the West, in the part of the mystical tradition. It means the terrible, wondrous, horrible, beautiful mystery of God. It's a very complex, layered meaning. And yesterday I tried to unpack a little bit of how I think this sort of mystical tradition can be helpful to us as we think about the world and the world, how we interact. And I went back to borrow from Friedrich von Hugel. He's a theologian from the beginning of the 20th century. He suggested that every valid religious tradition has three elements to it. He suggested that every it has an institution, a way of organizing itself. Lutherans have congregations that are more congregationally focused, and Roman Catholic Church has a pope with bishops and archbishops that are more recognizable. But there's some sort of traditional institution that reaches through the centuries, and it's a way of organizing yourself in the world. And also we have doctrines or teachings by which we understand truth. We have beliefs and ideas. Lutherans tend to emphasize the grace of God and therefore the inadequacies of their own human condition. I'm writing a book on Luther's view of prayer, and I found a metaphor that runs throughout Luther's life. And Luther's basic idea of the Christian life is that we were all beggars, ultimately, in the end. And because beggars have nothing to offer to somebody who offers them kindness, such as a Lord who lives in the land and comes to them. And even if the Lord marries you as a poor harlot, says Luther, and you have now become the queen of the land, you still have nothing of your own that you can claim. Everything you have is from the king. So there's these sorts of doctrinal or intellectual ideas that are important. But von Hugel's idea was, he was living at the tension of Darwinism and early time of the Scopes trial, and a lot of tension society between science and modernism and tradition. And he said he wanted to try to find a way to get people to talk, because he found that the two sides had become so shrilled and were on two sides. And he suggested that maybe the way to do this is to think about the fact, he was a scholar who studied mystical tradition, and he said there, in all religious traditions, we have this element of mystery. And there are people who are often identified as mystics within this tradition who emphasize the experiential side of the religious life. And by doing so, they have a tendency to emphasize love of God, love of neighbor, love of enemy, love of self, and love of God's creation. And what happens is these people who emphasize the mystical will sometimes become a thorn in the side of the people who are more institutional. People who might say you have to be Lutheran to be saved, the mystical would say, well, why is that? Doesn't God love everyone? You know, so they raise those sorts of questions. Or you have to believe a certain way to be saved. And so by coming to the way my students usually understand this question, when I ask them, usually the first day of class, I say, we spend the whole time trying to figure out what their religious background is so that I can teach to them and understand who they are. They'll usually say something like, I am spiritual, but not religious. Right? And what they mean is they tend not to belong to an institution or they don't believe in a particular way, but they do believe that they're spiritual in that they love God, they love others, and they see the barriers that are driven between people by too much emphasis on institution or doctrine as a problem, and so they say, I'm trying to emphasize the spiritual. And so von Hugel helps us a little bit in this by suggesting that the mystical tradition is important within any religious tradition because it calls the institution doctrine back to its core values of compassion. And I want to, this week I'm breaking this up into suggesting that there, this idea of wonder or mystery can be found in a few places. It can be found in the Word, and I'm going to explain that a little bit more in a minute. And I think we've had Fred doing that for us so wonderfully, the mystery and the beauty of the Word as it is exposed to us in the morning Bible studies. But von Hugel, now this is my idea. There are what I call, and I'm borrowing this term from John O'Donohue, thin places in the world in which there is like a very thin veil, like which you can see through the veil to the experience, have an experience of the divine, where something happens and you have a thick moment of time, where time slows down and you're mindful of the present moment. Like when I was sitting with the deer. And even though I gave you a movie of it, I think you got a sense of it, right? You kind of were surprised at the wonder when the deer kept going like this. I actually started filming that as the deer was walking away, and then he suddenly turned around. And the wonder and mystery of it was just the shock that this sort of thing just normally doesn't happen. But being in such close presence with the deer gave me, my wife and I, a moment of utter delight, which is this sort of experience. And there's other places in the world. I think some of these thin places can be like community, I'll talk about that tomorrow, suffering, and a thing called joy, and I will talk a lot about C.S. Lewis's view of that. But I think there's other places, intimacy, in a deep, loving, we could say erotic, relationship with another, in the imagination. Somebody, I was talking with somebody afterwards, and I think where music and the arts, have you ever listened to that concert or seen that sculpture or seen that painting or whatever it might be, it moves you to that thin place, right? Literature. We had David speaking yesterday about Ursula Le Guin, and I think literature can be a thin place in which we experience the divine. Study. I think sometimes just being involved in the pursuit of great questions and reading and that sort of thing can also be a place. Mindfulness is kind of like what we're trying to do in the moment a little bit more. Silence, whole religious traditions dedicated to silence, and also in the face of death. But today I want to talk about nature. And I'm going to start with a quote from, an idea from Thomas Aquinas. I want to go back to the 13th century. Aquinas says, and he's echoing a number of people at this point, especially Augustine, but a few others. He says that when God speaks to the world, God uses two books. The book of Revelation, what I call the wonder of the word, and the book of nature or creation, which I'm going to now talk about as nature or creation. Two books, the book of Revelation and the book of nature. His contemporary, Bonaventure, a Franciscan, said that when we look at the world, what we see is God's creation and God's fingerprints that are left upon that which he has created, that God has created. And when we see the fingerprints, we do not see the divine directly, but indirectly, as if we see God's backside, in a hint of going back to the idea of Moses in the Exodus story. So part of the reason for Bonaventure and for Aquinas why nature is so important is because God is in nature in the sense that God's creative hand is in the place. I remember when I got here, Paul said to me, "What do you think?" Right? And it was when I was asked to come to Holden, I knew this is the reason I wanted to come here, because I would see the fingerprint of God, right? You see that second book of Revelation, or that second book of creation. Bernard of Clairvaux, who Martin Luther loved dearly, Bernard of Clairvaux says, "I have no greater masters to teach me than the beeches and the oaks." Now, Bernard was a Cistercian. He was loved the monastic life, but he also loved nature very deeply, and so his idea comes through. I found it really interesting. There's a group of people like Douglas Burton Christie and others who are writing about today the idea of what they call spiritual geography. The idea that we are shaped as individuals by the surroundings in which we live. And to just give you a quick example, Sarah Rohde and I were talking, and Sarah's doing her internship in Manhattan, right? And she's a Midwest gal, but she says she has to escape to Central Park, right, to find life. And why is Central Park so important to New Yorkers? Because it's the one spot of creation that's left in a city of over 10 million people. And they go there regularly to experience something, that veil, that thin place. When you look back over history, we can find lots of examples of how spiritual geography works. Ancient peoples, let's go to the ancient Egyptians, they had a god called Ra, right? And Ra was the sun god. And if you've been in Egypt, you can see why, you know, that overpowering sun. I was in Egypt desert with some students. It was 120 degrees out, you know. You know why they thought of that as a god, right? And the god Ra worked with the goddess of the sky, Nut, and they become gods. And we have a lot of systems, but they're all connected to nature, right? Even the Greeks and the Romans had Apollo eventually, Helios in Greek, but they had Apollo really as the sun god. And it's interesting that Akhenaten in the ancient Egyptian tradition and Constantine, the first emperor who converts to Christianity, saw the sun god as the one god, the most powerful of all, because it was something very important to them. In fact, the earliest images of Jesus that we have, if you go back into the early church, are often Jesus sitting in a chariot riding across the sun and the sky, just like the god Apollo. And the Son of God and the sun god blurring the images as Constantine did. We see nature speaking through this. I've often wondered, you know, Jesus seems to be quite enamored of nature as well, right? He starts his ministry by going into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. He often takes a few disciples aside to pray, but where? In the mountains, or when he meets the people, when he gives the Beatitudes, he's on a mountain, mirroring Moses in a lot of ways. Then technology gets in the way. Even when Jesus, in his last moments, in his great despair, he goes to a garden, right? We often see that these thin places, like Holden Village, I think, of nature, where the fingerprint of God is so close, we experience the divine. It's one of those thin places, and we have lots of thick moments. Now, let me do a little bit of history and talk about this in a way, and then we'll get back to some important ideas. I want to go back, first of all, to a man by the name of Anthony. Anthony dies in 356. He will be 105 years old, very unusual for a person of this time. Anthony, when he was 18 years old, is sitting in worship service, and the scripture is read, "Go and sell all that you have and give it to the poor." The wonder of the word. Anthony was wealthy. His parents had died. He had a lot of money. He gives some of his money, sets his sister up, his only other living relative, in a way she's kind of like in an early monastic community with other women. And Anthony wonders what he should do. He decides to go to the desert. And he does go to the desert because there he wants to find God. He thinks Jesus went to the desert. John the Baptist was in the desert. The people of Israel were in the desert. They all found God in the desert. Maybe I can find God there too. Well, he goes into the desert, and he lives there for a very, very long time. And eventually people start coming to him, seeing him as a holy man. Constantine, the emperor, will actually ask him for advice at one point. And he is so connected to the land and the spirituality of the place that it's hard to separate him from it. I read a story about 10 years ago of an Ohio man who was sitting in a pew. I believe it was Toledo, if I remember the story right. And he was sitting there and he heard the scripture, "Go and sell all that you have and give it to the poor." And he did. He followed Anthony. He just thought it was the exact same thing. He wanted to go into a monastic community, and he gave away everything and he gave it to the poor. The problem was that his children took him to court, got him certified as being insane, and had him committed to an institution so that they could get his money back. In the ancient world, some people are saints. In our world, they're insane, right? There is a certain insanity to running off to places out in the wilderness where you don't have any technology or that, but where you come to be close to the divine. Another person like that was Saint Benedict of Nursia. Benedict was the founder of the Benedictine monastic order. And Benedict was the same thing. He was a nobleman from Rome. And he said the city's distractions kept gnawing at him, and he wanted to find the place where he could be close to God. And so the story, as it's told by Gregory the Great in the Dialogues, Book 2, says he went off into the wilderness. And I thought, in my own mind, wow, wilderness, just outside of Rome, about an hour away. So I decided that I was going to take a group of students to see this wilderness. And we went on a bus through this. The roads were even worse than the ones getting up here to Holden. I mean, they're, you know, gigantic cliffs, and it'd be like driving around up there. And it was, you know, very precarious. But as we kept going up, I was shocked because it was beautiful like this place. It reminded me very much like this place, except not as much snow. And when we got up there, we got off the bus and we were stunned into silence because there was a waterfall. There was this ancient monastery dug out into the side of this mountain, and this almost 90-year-old monk walked out very slowly to us, and his name is Brother John. And he just looked at us, and then he finally said, "So what do you think?" And one of my students said, "It is so beautiful." He just smiled. And I said, "Now wait a minute, in the Dialogues of Gregory, it says he went into the wilderness. This isn't a wilderness. What do you think? We're stupid?" Monks don't go where you cannot find God. And this is the most beautiful place on earth to me. I've been here, he was there for some 70 years as a monk. It was astonishing. Monks aren't stupid. They go to the place where you find beauty. In John O'Donohue's book, Beauty, The Invisible Embrace, he does talk about finding the fingerprint of God in thin places. And he's Celtic, and he talks about the story of St. Patrick. I don't know if you know Patrick's story. He was grew up in a noble family. Sorry to see a pattern here. Semi-noble family. He lives in southern England. And some raiders, Irish raiders, come into his town. They capture him at the age of 16, and they take him off into slavery in Ireland, where he becomes a shepherd. He lives up in some mountains by himself for 10 years. While he's there, suddenly, in this beautiful space of Ireland, the beautiful creativity of this wonderful land, he starts hearing the voice of God through an angel. And one day the angel says, "It's time for you to leave." He said, "I'm a slave. If I leave this place, I get killed." "No, you're supposed to leave." So he walks out of the village, walks down to a boat, and he says, the voice says, "That's your boat. Take it." And he goes to the man and says, "I'm supposed to go on this boat." And he says, "Well, no, you're not. This is my boat. You can't come with me." And so he starts walking away, and he doesn't know what to do. And the man says, "Oh, come back. You can join me." And they went on the boat, and the boat is shipwrecked, and it says they were stuck in a desert for a number of years. It happened to be France. but in a wilderness. Notice how the wilderness language is still used. And then he becomes a priest, and when he decides what he must do in his ministry, where does he go? To the land he was a slave for 10 years. Utterly astonishing. Well, it says Patrick went back and he looked for the wilderness in Ireland but couldn't find it because it's all green. So he called the sea around Ireland the wilderness. And monks went out into the islands and lived on the islands around, surrounded by the desert of the sea, of the ocean. But the Celts are very, very close to nature. And part of this is that it goes back to the Irish mindset. Back, the old idea was the Irish gods, that there was this great big battle, and that and this is the stories of the Druids, and that the gods were forced into the other world, and humans were allowed to live without their interference too much. But there were thin places in Ireland. Oak groves, ancient groves of trees. And when I walked out here through some of these groves of trees, I thought of the Irish and that thin place. You know, these were places where people might come into contact with the gods of Ireland. They were lakes and mountains and all the places that we would call the fingerprints of God. Are you getting hot? I don't know about you, but I am a little bit. Yes. Is there a way to open some windows a little bit?
Those
windows don't go to outside, so the door is better. Okay. Oh, this way? Okay, well, hopefully that we need nature in here. It's too cold. I need windows. So John O'Donohue says, he was an Irish priest who later left the priesthood and got married. He has this quote in his book. He says, "Our senses are lanterns that illuminate the world. And what we see is beauty. Beauty awakens for us through what we hear, touch, taste, scent, and see. Beauty awakens in us the great traditions that have always recognized that beauty is God. Wherever you see beauty, God is not far away. Beauty is more than what the senses can perceive, but beauty always awakens the soul." So whenever we see beauty, says O'Donohue, the beauty points beyond itself to that great beauty, capital B, who is God. Augustine once, in his great prayer, says, "O beauty, so ancient and so new, my soul has sought after you like a bird flying out into the world, making its nest in the highest tree. And there I could not find you in taste, scent, smell, all the senses. And when I came back to rest in myself, I found you within me, within my heart. O beauty, so ancient and so new." I did a translation of this text, and Rene Clausen has turned it into a musical piece for the King Singers, so I'm hoping that that'll actually get out. But it's in a magnificent poem, but notice how Augustine's language of beauty draws us all in. It's a mystical language which doesn't have any of the sorts of trappings, but nevertheless can draw people from a variety of traditions in. The problem for us in experiencing the beauty of the world is exactly why we need places like Holden. Because in the world, we live in fast time, not thick time, right? Everything demands of us to go faster. The work that we do, I love Fred's comment the other day, said he teaches for free, but he gets paid to grade papers, right? His papers are the thing that make time go, you know. You wish it would go by faster, maybe. But it goes by fast. Those tasks that we get involved in our lives, that suddenly we just feel like, how did I get to be 50? How did I get here? I don't, you know, your heart, it was like a speed bump on the way. You have these mystical moments that slow us down, but time seems to go by fast. And our places become ugly. The world around us becomes a difficult place. I have a theory about religion that I call tofu. And it's pretty simple. Religious traditions need things in order to give them life. And what does it need? It has to take on, every religious tradition has to take on some personality of its own. It can be true to its institution or doctrine, but it takes on its personality. When I was at Notre Dame, I went to Lutheran churches in Notre Dame, and they were very, very high church, very, very Catholic. Of course, it's a very Catholic area. Catholic churches in North Dakota are very, very low church. See what they're doing? They're trying to minimize the differences between the majority that's there. And so we become, it's a little bit like tofu. Tofu isn't really, I mean, it's very nutritious, but it doesn't taste really good unless you put a little soy sauce, get some of that tomatoes, you know, and start mixing it up. It tastes fantastic, you know, tofu is really good, but it needs other things to give it life. The same thing is true of that religious tradition. It always takes on the nature or the spirituality of the place around us. One of the great violences that we do in our society is allow people in poverty in large cities to have no nature to experience. Because we remove from them a thin veil or place in which truth can be found, or beauty can be found. When I was in college at Pacific Lutheran University my senior year, I was a triple major, religion, classics, and philosophy, and all of those demanded a senior paper, so I decided to write something I could do all three at once. And I did St. Francis of Assisi, and I was looking at his life, and I just went in there to try to see what I found was interesting. And what I was really struck by was Francis lives in this small little mountain town. I've taken my students there as well. And they, in Assisi, Francis, he was a wealthy playboy. He drank a lot. He caroused with women. He had a good time. And then he went off on crusade and became very ill. He nearly died in a battle. And he came back with this, after he had this near-death mystical sort of experience about things. And suddenly he awoken. He came out of the illness to see the beauty of the land, of the place where he lives. It's remarkably beautiful. Anybody been to Assisi? You liked it? It's a beautiful place, a little dry, but I mean it's spectacularly beautiful up there. And Francis became awakened to the nature around him. And suddenly he was doing crazy things that we would lock people up for, like preaching to the birds, or telling wolves that they shouldn't eat the sheep in the area, and that he would get the townspeople to help them eat. They would feed him every day, this terrible wolf, the Wolf of Gubbio, one of the great stories. But towards the end of his life, Francis went blind. He wrote a hymn when he went blind. It's really based on Psalm 148. His love of nature comes through the hymn. Let me just read part of it to you. Most high, all-powerful, good Lord, you alone are the ones we ought to offer praise, glory, and honor, and blessing. We belong to you, all created by you, and we are not worthy to call your name. Still we praise you and all your creatures, especially my brother Sun, who this day and through whom you give us light. He is beautiful and radiant and great in splendor and bears your likeness, O Holy One. And praise be to you, O Lord, for our sister moon and our sister the stars in the heaven. You formed them clear and precious and beautiful. Praise to you, O Lord, for our brother wind, and through the air and the clouds and the serenity of the weather that you give us. You sustain us and all living creatures. Praise be to you, my Lord, for sister water, which is very useful and humble and precious and chaste and gives of herself willingly to us every day. Praise be to you, my Lord, for brother fire, who you light the night, for he is beautiful, playful, robust, and strong. Praise be to you, my Lord, through sister mother earth, who sustains and governs us and produces all fruit and colored flower and herb for all of us. Praise be to you, my Lord, through those of you, through those who give pardon for your love and bear intimacy in tribulation. Blessed are you who endure in peace. Blessed are you even for our brother death, who comes to us to bring us home to you. Praise and bless my Lord, and give him thanks, serve him with all humility. I was working on this thesis, and a great scholar by the name of Ray Petrie, one of the great Franciscan scholars, was in a nursing home close by. And I went to visit him, and I told him that I was writing this thesis on Francis. And I said, can you give me any insight into this? And this is, remember, this is 1974. Excuse me, not quite that far back, 1978, excuse me. And I went to talk with him, and he said, for Francis, and I actually had a tape recorder going, so I could record him at the time. For Francis, God's creation caused him to wonder and properly praise God aright. God's world always points to God. Beauty shows beauty. The ecological crisis threatens our entire species and our entire world. Perhaps our very ability to praise God is at stake. For you could clear away all the forests and put in parking lots. You could build concrete skyscrapers to the heavens and blot out the skies so that you can't even see the trees anymore. And you can build your summer homes in the mountains and drive the wolves from their habitat. But in the end, you can do what you want, but you will never, ever be able to praise God again because you will not know how. I was very struck and moved by his words, and he told me to read an article by Lynn White Jr. called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. Lynn White Jr. was a medieval scholar, and his basic argument in the article, this is written in the late 1960s, said that the problem with our world is that Christianity and other religious traditions have used the phrase from Genesis to subdue the world, to use the earth as if it's a commodity. That we use it as a way to become richer without regard for what we're doing to the world. Holden is an interesting example of this, isn't it? Right? You know, with the copper mine that used to be here, and then Holden's come in and tried to reclaim the sacred place of this, and now we're in the process of struggling, especially Holden is struggling with the cleanup and the mess that was made here for the issue of money and for the idea of making it a commodity. So Lynn White Jr. said, let us go back to the days of St. Francis and make him the patron saint of ecology. And he is to this day on his recommendation. Another example, and then I think we'll open up for a little conversation, but how does this work? We have this thin place called nature in which we see the fingerprints of the divine. We have moments where time slows down, like when we run into the deer or we're standing up at Holden Lake or some beautiful thing. I bet you can all think of that moment. I took a group of students to Egypt one time, and we climbed Mount Sinai at 2 in the morning so we could sit and watch the sunrise from Mount Sinai. I was not the same person walking down the mountain as I was walking up. It was life transforming, life changing. So how does this work? I'll give you a human example of how I think this works a little bit. You all know Harriet Beecher Stowe, right? You wouldn't expect me to use her name at this point. You know that in the 19th century, she was a New England teacher. She married a theology professor. She wrote many stories, wrote for Mood magazines. And then in 1851, she wrote her famous book,
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And you know the subtitle? Life Among the Lowly. Uncle Tom's Cabin, Life Amongst the Lowly. When Abraham Lincoln met her, he said, and I quote, "So you're the little woman who started this big war." Now, one of the things that we do not know often about Harriet Beecher Stowe is that she had a great sense. She considered herself a nature mystic. And I want to read to you, she has a number of hymns that she has about nature. This is her morning hymn, which I think is quite beautiful. "Still, still with thee, when purple morning breaketh, when the bird waketh and the shadows flee, fairer than morning, lovelier than daylight, dawns the sweet consciousness that I am with thee. alone with thee, amidst the mystic shadows, the solemn hush of nature newly born, alone with thee in breathless adoration, in calm dew and freshness of the morn, still, still with thee. As to each newborn morning, a fresh solemn splendor still is given, so does the blessed consciousness awaken, breath each day nearness to thee and to heaven. So shall it be at last, in that bright morning, when the soul waketh and the life's shadows flee. Oh, in that hour fairer than daylight dawning shall rise the glorious thought that I am with thee. She is an interesting person because if you read about her life, nature changed her. And she said that understanding the beauty of nature would no longer permit her to allow the ugliness of slavery to go unchallenged. When you know beauty through nature, you will no longer be able to resist the urge to make the world as beautiful as that place is. And so Harriet Beecher Stowe, out of her insistence, was awakened by beauty and then challenged and resisted the world that she was in and changed it. A rather powerful example to all of us. If you think back to the examples I gave a few minutes ago, the Desert Fathers, St. Anthony and St. Benedict. Benedict founded a religious order that went into the rural areas and went to live with the poor and the needy. And what did they do? They educated the needy. They fed them when they had nothing to eat. They set up hospitals. And they took care of the society and the people around them willingly, without cost. What did Francis do? Francis was of the mendicant order. And when the cities started developing in the 13th century, and there were poor people in the cities, the monks and nuns were taking care of the people in the rural areas. There was nobody to take care of the poor. So Francis and his brothers and his sisters gave up their wealth, became poor, and became the primary means of taking care of the lepers and the needy and the hungry in that society. And they still both have those charisms to this day. Their love and appreciation of the nature and beauty that was around them moved them to get rid of the ugliness of the world, to be involved and engaged in a way that we tend to be a bit surprised in. But one other thing is also really important to bring up, and that is that I said at the beginning of this that as nature is a thin place, we are moved through thin places and thick time to care about the care of the world, about the experience of God, of the neighbor, of the enemy, of ourselves, but also of all creation. And the responsibility of issues of sustainability and, well, one of the great missions that Holden has that teaches people when they come here to understand that work and trying to keep this place beautiful so that people might experience the divine here is absolutely essential. We see the fingerprint of God in creation, and it does not allow us to see an ugly world and not do something about it. Well, let me stop for a minute and see what comments or thoughts or ideas that you might have.
Roy, have you experienced thin spots in nature in North Dakota?
Oh, absolutely. In the midst of a blizzard, in a car with three kids, it's a thin place because you're on the edge of this.
I wasn't thinking so much about that.
But no, absolutely. The beauty, there's a different kind of beauty in different places. But
the point is, being from in Minnesota, I've heard this so many times. I mentioned I used to live in North Dakota, and I say, well, I've been across the state, there's nothing. And I've been at the prairie, the virgin prairie, where the wind comes, and it's like an ocean. And I think a lot of people just don't perceive beauty where it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the great tragedies of North Dakota right now is the oil boom in Williston, North Dakota. My oldest son is making a documentary about the Williston oil boom and what it's doing to the area. and they're fracking these oil wells, and there are gigantic fracking pits that fill entire fields of oil sludge that are on the countryside. There is, and nobody, not many people know about it, but up in Alberta, Canada, the same sort of fracking is going on, and one pit is half the size of Manhattan, and that's in Alberta. And so, again, what happens is using the earth as a commodity, right? This oil is precious. People, if you watch things on the news and you hear how great it is in North Dakota, well, we do only have 3% unemployment, so we're pretty fortunate. We have $2 billion in the coffers, in our state coffers. We have no problems whatsoever, but we're paying a tremendous price.
There's research, you know, about nature's power to heal, that people who are actually out in nature, their blood pressure lowers and all of that. And it just makes me think about, you know, the healing that must happen in this place. I was talking to a 20-year-old yesterday who was talking about, I come to the mountain to find out what to do with my life. You know, I come to the mountain to figure out where I am and who I am. And I think a lot of, besides just the perceiving of nature and beauty, there is something actually physical that God is doing in our bodies just by being in the presence of nature.
Oh, I agree completely.
Yeah, it's really exciting and beautiful to think about what is happening, just being here.
Yeah, how many of you came here just, I mean, that's a big part of being here, right? It's hard to get here. I mean, that's the first thing. And then when you get here, that you can leave that for me, that's one of the best things, to leave the technology behind. Although I did take a movie. actually, I'm trying, maybe it's part of the arts. So, but there is, you know, leaving the technology behind, because technology makes time go fast, it makes places tick, and it really removes us from who we are as individuals. You come here to find yourself. Right? To see the beauty in yourself, to be overwhelmed by the nature. And one of the things I said yesterday about mystical experience, we are all mystics. We have a tendency to see, well, you know, Hildegard of Bingen or Julie of Norwich or some of these great mystics of the past, we see them as unusual and say, those are just, oh, that's special people. But when we realize that we are lost in the moment in which something profound happens to us when we're walking in nature, and our lives are changed, like Harriet Beecher Stowe. Our lives are changed. We cannot live the same way as people. We have to be different because we want to search for beauty. That's powerful. And so we come back to this place regularly, or we find refuges. Why are there so many people living on lakes with lake homes in the country, or on the oceans, or that? It's because we have to escape the city. But what are we escaping? We're escaping the phone. And we're escaping to the nature where we can get to the thin place again, right? I don't know, other thoughts or, yeah?
A comment, my watch stopped working when I got here. I don't have it on anymore, the battery.
They have the special electric pulse.
They have a special. And the second thing is, on your mystical experiences and the effectiveness of worship of nature, where does animism come into your
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, there's a couple ways. Christianity's always been worried about pantheism, right? This notion that God is nature. But a lot of people are talking about panentheism, that God embraces all and is in, you know, all, right? God is, as Luther would use the term, ubiquitous in every place, right? And so in that sense, that God is in creation, and not God necessarily is creation, but God is in it there, you know, that's a new way of thinking about it, and therefore people who are concerned about sustainability issues and environment and that see the sacredness and beauty of the nature. And that's been a part of the Christian tradition for a long time. Animism traditions, like the Celts, for example, one of the things really remarkable about the Irish is when Patrick went back to the land that had enslaved him and he was talking to them about God, he used images, shamrocks and other nature images that they understood. And there was no bloodshed in that conversion. In a lot of other places, there's bloodshed. Boniface, the great missionary to Germany to try to convert the people who worship the Norse gods there, you know, he's killed after he cuts down the oak of Woden, you know, and turns it into a church. He cuts down the tree and then puts the boards into a church to get the people to come, right? There's an interesting transition there, but later on there's a group that's not too happy with him, so they stick a sword in his head, and he dies. So but it's interesting there, that sort of animism. Patrick doesn't really, there's stories about Patrick shape-shifting, that this guy who was upset with Patrick because he had converted some of his slaves was coming to find Patrick, and Patrick suddenly turns into a deer and walks away. Completely consistent with the Irish tradition of animistic sort of ideas. And the Irish are, I find O'Donohue and others, they have a sensitivity to nature that other religious traditions don't in some ways. Not, they're unique even within Catholicism. The Celts, because Catholicism has other strains, it's a part of their spirituality, and I think we can learn a lot from them. If you ever go there, or Iona, the monastery, has anybody been to Iona? Some people, again, part of their spirituality is a Celtic spirituality. We forget that we have this as a part of our tradition because the Celts preserved the libraries when the Roman Empire fell apart, and they brought them back to Europe, right? And so there are strong traditions of the Celts bringing back learning, but also with it some of this nature spirituality.
And how about shamanism?
Again, you know, that's
There's
that sort of it ties in with kind of what I was talking about with the sun gods and right. Mystical. You know, again, it's trying to explain the unexplainable. But every religious tradition knows that nature is this thin place. I think.
What would you say about I think the tendency in our society to want to own it?
Oh, yeah. To own it. What would you think? Say more, obviously. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, there's a strong strain in especially wealthy Americans to want to be in these beautiful places, but then it's to own it and keep it from others.
Yeah. I mean, you know, thank goodness there were people like Theodore Roosevelt and others who set aside huge tracts of land and, you know, for places that they... In North Dakota, we're debating in the legislature whether they could drill in our national forests, oil, you know. It's like, you know, and everybody's saying, well, that's not a bad idea. You know, the government can make a lot more money. And you're going to ruin all this? It's, you know, the Badlands in North Dakota are really spectacularly beautiful. Unfortunately, it was voted down, but it was a huge fight, you know. We have to fight, I think, to keep that. But you're right, the desire to own and then use it as a commodity.
And to somehow enhance yourself, but not allow others to be there.
And again, that's why we need places like Holden.
You know, a couple of years ago, one of the Ken Burns series on the national parks, I'd commend to anyone.
Yeah.
It was superbly done, and the sort of the central premise of it was that national parks were, I think the title was, America's best or greatest idea. And it differentiates from places in Europe where the rich did own the most beautiful places, and how that even took a foothold here, Niagara Falls, and how it became commercialized, and how, you know, the prophets like John Muir and Roosevelt and really led the creation of these wilderness places. And it's so well done because it tells a lot of story of people's transformative times, and people from current day, not just people like John Muir, but people from current day, and how times in national parks and wilderness really does, as you, the terms you use, are thin places.
And people escape to them. You know, Yosemite in California, I mean, you know, all the people in Los Angeles and San Francisco, you know, they escape to these places. Notice what I'm saying. We escape, you know, we escape to come here because we know something in our world militates against our being in the thin place or thick time that we need to be just human, to be ourselves.
I think Minnesota has done a really good job in one area, and that's that with all the lakes we have, the vast majority of them have public access.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few that are privately held, but mostly, even if it's privately held, there's a place that you can get on the lake and still be on the lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're seeing Beauty in the Prairie rebuild homes as a horizontal grandeur. You know that, is it? Contrast horizontal landscapes with vertical landscapes. You know, vertical landscapes stand in front of you, you see the beauty all at once, but horizontal beauty is a very well written essay. But we should say something about the eye of the beholder. How much of the thin place is about the landscape, and how much of it is about the perception?
I think it's both. I mean, there's certainly a sensitivity. What's great about Holden and places like this is it makes us aware that this is something that's important. But you know, we get trained, I think, in the natural world. Why is Las Vegas a draw? I don't understand it. You know, the neon lights and flashing things, but it's like we're flies, you know? We go to it and we buzz around it and our lives are active and we gamble and we hope for more. And there is that sort of side to it. But there's something about nature when we get into it, if we can take the time. There's a movie by the guy who did Slumdog Millionaire, Danny Boyle. It's a horrible movie because it's hard to watch. It's about drug-addicted people. But there's this really interesting scene. These guys are slipping into drug addiction, and the one guy thinks he's going to rescue him, and he takes him out to the mountains. And the one guy looks up at him and goes, ugh, and he walks back to the city and gets involved in drugs. But one guy is affected by the moment of looking at the mountain. You know, and so, you know, you're right. It's a little bit of both, but I think we can create the sensitivity through awareness, through study, through some of those sorts of things. And some people seem to have greater sensitivities to it. Francis, when he came through that near-death experience, just loves nature. That hymn to nature is so incredible. He even sees death as a sister. And fire, you know, that's fascinating. Yeah,
I'm wondering about the transformation that occurs. You talked about being in Egypt and coming down a different person than you were when you went up.
Mm-hmm.
And we all go down from this mountain too at some point.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I mean, when you were talking about Harriet Beecher Stowe,
mm-hmm.
that witnessing and receiving beauty made the ugliness almost more clear, something mm-hmm. we needed to do something about. But I also think that...
I can't, just stop real there, real quick. When you go back from this place, don't you look at your closets differently?
Oh, yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Well,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's all part of it, but I also wonder if sometimes part of the transformation is seeing what we might quickly deem ugly as beautiful or potentially bearing beauty.
Well, yeah. You look for the beauty in it. Yeah.
Even, you know, living in the South Bronx, the first week, I only saw filth, litter, pollution, noise, Camino Central Park. But the longer I'm there, the more I see beauty breaking in and transforming my...
You see the dandelion propping through the, you know. Yeah. Beauty will win out in the end, right? It will always try to find a way. I mean, we'll snuff it out wherever we can, but it will try to find a way. Henry Nouwen, who many of you know in his writings, said that, you know, he was one time in a big city and he couldn't find anything and he saw a single rose. And he stopped and was just transformed by the rose. And it reminded me of the quote by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis once said, "God closes in on me on a summer day or in the flower of a bush, and I cannot escape." You know, just in that moment, you know.
I'm just going to say that I'm increasingly troubled by a generation of children who are nature deprived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of fear that there's, you know, of strangers, or out of the pace, we don't have time to go explore.
Well, it's interesting.
A whole generation that never get their fingers dirty.
Or don't know how to, you
know,
don't know where their food comes from, or, you know, all those, the basic elemental things. I love film, and I teach a religion and film class, and one of the things that we notice and explore is that if you look at horror movies, for example, what is horrible to youth? And if youth are from the city, horror movies take place in the cabin in the woods. The woods are dangerous. Because the city is the place of safety, and somehow out there the danger lurks. And if you're from the rural areas, the city scares you. but you're right. You know, oftentimes even our horror films reflect this almost abhorrence of nature, that something's going to happen out there. It's dangerous. It's ugly. And you know, you're right. It's a real problem. You know, we need to get, I love what Holden does here, where everybody does dishes, everybody kind of gets involved in the work. And a lot of our kids grow up and they don't even know how to work anymore. They don't know how to plant a flower, see, you know, we're so removed from nature, everything has become plastic, even our flowers.
We were involved in our congregation with the program, the local social service agency that was dealing with a program for at-risk kids, and these are kids that are getting troubled. So part of their probation, they go through this program. And someone got the idea to give the kids cameras and then to have a photo show, and then we've gotten support by a corporation to make all this possible. And they were sent out, and these kids had never had a camera before. And they were sent out with the assignment, the title of the show is going to be Broken and Beautiful. And that's all they told the kids. So they came back with these pictures, and then they had them framed, and then you saw them. And it was just amazing, because you got to see the world through these eyes. And we could see what they were looking at. You had pictures of graffiti, you had pictures of the ocean, you had pictures of kids and this and that. And it was really a wonderful kind of thing.
The human soul longs for that. I want to close with a quote by Rumi. Rumi is a famous mystic. I was just in Turkey with a group of alumni from Concordia. We went to Rumi's tomb and read a lot of Rumi's poetry. He's one of the great mystics. One of the things about mystical experiences is that when you start emphasizing compassion, mysticism across religions is a lot closer. You know, you suddenly appreciate the writings of others. But Rumi said, let the beauty that you see be the beauty that you do. Thanks for coming. Appreciate it.